Though young in years and relatively new to power, John F. Kennedy seemed to us, to the American people, something more than a man and even something more than a president. His vitality, his proven courage, his outreaching knowledge, his cultivated yet straightforward speech marked him for us as one of that new breed of men who were equal to the challenges of an awesome age. The president buoyed up our confidence. He added a tall measure to our assurance that even as our fathers had tamed the wilderness, we would be able to tame the new frontiers of the mass man and of the massive city and of the Holocaustial bomb. His death sapped our self-assurance. As his coffin was lowered into the Arlington ground, tomorrow became a more frightening prospect. We had sent out one of our bravest and one of our best, and he had not returned. There would be peace and decency, but we recognized now its sacrificial price. A deep grief beats us to our knees. And deep grief also unlocks and opens the wellsprings of anger. We would undo the irrevocable. Struggling with fate, we brush up against our mortal frame, our own innate limitation. We become angry with ourselves and our bitterness spills over against others. And we were angry that fatal weekend. We were angry with ourselves. A young leader had challenged the habits of our service. His death laid bare the slender pattern of our citizenship. We had not really asked ourselves what we might do for our country. We were angry with others that fatal weekend. The death, the senseless, brutal death of this young leader seemed far too great a sacrifice to the demons of irresponsibility and of violence. Dallas had been for a while a national symbol of ugly vituperation and of irresponsible excess. The young hero had dared the monster in his lair and had been laid bare by one fiery blast. I was angry, as you were most of that weekend. And I was especially angry with the mass media, with the television. I felt then, and I still feel, that they invaded unnecessarily the privacy of a family's grief. And I felt then, though I no longer believe, that they dwelt overlong on the private and intimate facts of the funeral. I sensed then that we were paying our debt, our perfunctory visit, our funeral call to the president too easily. At ease in our living room, we were shedding a gentle tear. That was all. Somehow we were remembering the man almost with a maudlin sentimentality. We were forgetting his greatness. For he asked us not for our tear, for our talents, not for our sympathy, but for our steadfastness, not for our grief, but for the greatness of the nation. After all, the living honor the dead not by eulogy, but by effort, by continuing the loyalties which were shared, by abiding the principles which had been intertwined. We cried. We watched. We were purged. We remembered the man. We forgot his mission. We remembered the man. We forgot his message. We remembered the man. We forgot his mandate. That November weekend of 1963, we watched, you and I, a threefold tragedy. There was the stark tragedy of a sudden, brutal, unnecessary killing. For lo, the wicked bend the bow. They place the arrow upon the drawstring that they may shoot in darkness at the upright in heart. We watched, too, that weekend, the drama of a nation suddenly face to face with its own continuity. I shall never forget the scene of the president's mementos, those rather large models of Navy craft being wheeled down the White House driveway within a matter of hours of his death. The business of government, of leadership, must go on. The king is dead. Long live the king. There is a time to laugh and a time to cry. There is a time to grieve and a time to leave off grieving. There is a time to scatter stones. There is a time to gather the stones up together again. And finally, there was the excitement of the manhunt, its completion in the capture of the assassin, and then the unexpected twist and turn of events in the assassin's assassination. The Lord will pour out rain of coal upon the head of the wicked. Fire and brimstone and the burning wind, these shall be the cup of their portion. It was a moving, weakening, demanding, disturbing weekend. As assassinations go, it was at first glance passing strange. Presidents, as you know, move in a glare of publicity. Generally, the assassination of such a man takes place for no better reason than that a little man from the shadow world wants to share in the limelight. A twilight man, one of the anonymous masses, reaches up for his moment to be known, to be seen. And so we have John Wilkes Booth jumping, shouting in the box of President Lincoln. We have Kosciuszko standing quietly in the receiving line, a fallen McKinley at his feet, the revolver in his hand, waiting patiently to be captured. His destiny had been fulfilled. And at first glance, it seemed that this assassination was somewhat different. All we saw in those first moments, all we heard, rather, was of a shot, or shots, and of the presidential cavalcade speeding to the hospital. In time, Lee Harvey Oswald was found to be another of this band of the anonymous men, of the little men who was attracted as the moth to the flame by the glare of publicity, notoriety of fame which surrounds a president. But then we did not know. Within a matter of minutes, the site of the shooting had been found. Within 3 hours, the murderer was in police custody. The sixth floor of the nearby Texas School Depository building was found to have been the site of the shooting. The fatal rifle was located there near a carefully camouflaged site. Lee Harvey Oswald was run to earth in a neighborhood Dallas theater after having been seen shooting in cold blood and brutally a city policeman. It all seemed clear and over. The murderer was caught. There would be a trial, perhaps ultimately a confession, and history could write fini to this piece. And then, 24 hours later, on the Sunday next, all was suddenly unraveled. As Oswald, as you recall, was being transferred from the Dallas police station to the county jail, he was suddenly shot. Jack Ruby, the assassin's assassin, was immediately apprehended. But new questions presented themselves. Why was Oswald shot, and by whom? Was he shot to be silenced? Was he a member of some conspiracy which had yet to be unmasked and named? These questions demanded answers, clear, unqualified, unequivocal answers. And President Johnson appointed an investigatory commission headed by the Chief Justice of the United States to make a full and public search of all facts surrounding the twin killings and to report these to us when a decision had been reached. The results have now, as you know, been published. The work is monumental. The research, the search, and the investigation has been exhaustive. But fortunately, the conclusions are clear and unqualified. The president was shot by a lonely, desperate man who acted on his own. He was not a member of any conspiracy. Lee Harvey Oswald was shot by a lonely and desperate man who acted on his own. There was no conspiracy. Neither Oswald nor Jack Ruby was an agent or a counteragent of any government or of any subversive element. Indeed, the whole geography of this senseless murder is to be drawn from the world of emotional pathology rather than from the passions of politics and the Cold War. Thus, their conclusion. And I am convinced that history will be satisfied with this verdict. Though I am equally certain that the imaginative and the creative mind will not. I am sure that our children will go to theater some years hence and see a gripping drama which reopens the issue and leaves the solution unresolved. For drama requires tension and uncertainty. And there are, of course, those who were predetermined not to accept such a verdict. We have had in our nation now for some 20 years the peddlers of conspiracy, men and women who feed on the fears of the fearful, and who tell these pitiful people that there is a far-reaching, manifold, many-tentacled conspiracy reaching out from Washington, sapping and undermining the strength of the nation. Anyone who can believe that a vast majority of our public servants are communists or communist sympathizers. Anyone who can believe that President Eisenhower and President Kennedy and the Chief Justice are communists or communist sympathizers, such people will easily and readily believe that Lee Harvey Oswald, this little pitiful man, was a member of a communist conspiracy. As proof, his politics, which were Marxian. At the age of 19, he had appealed to the Russian government for citizenship. He was a member of a Fair Play for Cuba committee. His politics will be rehearsed. And none will remember that an impartial commission of the senior representatives and senators of our land said in their report, there was no conspiracy, that Oswald acted on his own. What will they do with this report? Shrug it off, pass it off, or simply say that these honorable men were themselves members of some presumed conspiracy. And there will be those who will go one step further, the prejudiced, the satanic. For here is a delightful proof of the Jew communist conspiracy. How fortunate for these people that the man who struck down the murderer of the president had been born Jack Rubinstein. Now, Jack Ruby was a tinhorn gambler, one who lived on the outskirts of the underworld. There was nothing that was noble, there was nothing certainly that was Jewish, and there was less that was political in his life. He simply seems to have been one of that breed of men who lives near and for violence. Call him a name, he takes a punch. Call him a dirty Jew, and he strikes back. Strike down near him the President of the United States, and he turns instinctively, innately somehow to violence. The Warren Commission had this conclusion on Jack Ruby's murder. That he killed Lee Harvey Oswald, and I quote here, that Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald in a fit of depression and of anger brought on by the assassination of the president. No conspiracy, no communist affiliation. But those who are prone to believe that all of us, by our very fact of birth within this faith, are members of that conspiracy, any such will readily believe The President of the United States was caught in the maw of a giant Jew communist conspiracy. And you can be sure that this message will be heard in the emotional underworld of our land. Who shot the President? Reasonable men read the report of reasonable and honorable men, and they will be satisfied. Those who trade on the sensational, the newspapers which will sell their souls for sales, those who peddle this conspiracy, who delight to call themselves the protectors of our democracy, they will not be satisfied. Reasonable men will. Who killed the President of the United States? A lonely, a disturbed, a desperate little man, Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, Lee Harvey Oswald was a terribly sick person, as well as a cold-blooded killer. A year before his assassination of the President, he had attempted the assassination of another terribly sick and disturbed man, the racist and bigot, retired Major General Edwin Walker, and he nearly succeeded. And his wife, Oswald's wife, in testimony before the commission revealed that some 6 months before the attack on the President, there had been a terrible family argument, for Oswald had announced to her that he intended that day to shoot at Richard Nixon. For the good of society, this 24-year-old man belonged within the walls of an institution for the criminally insane. But if there is much that is pathological in his history, there is equally much that is only pathetic. Oswald's father died before he was born. His mother was married 3 times, never happened. She seems to have been a disturbed and vituperative and ugly and prejudiced and self-involved woman. As a youngster, Oswald was raised by relatives, by babysitters, in an orphanage, and occasionally, on rare occasions, by his mother, who was rarely that. Lee Harvey Oswald was a solitary child. He withdrew into himself. When he had reached out for love as a child, it had been denied him, and he found what little peace he could find, apparently, within his own person. He walked alone. He walked unhappily. By the age of 13, he had been declared an educational truant in New York City. And he was remanded to the youth house there for psychiatric examination. And the doctors reported to him as being evasive, withdrawn, and solitary. They spoke of the lack of family, of the absence of love, of emotional isolation and deprivation, of a mother who was self-involved and conflicted. This was the youth of Lee Harvey Oswald. Reading it, you have the sense of a growing desperation, of an animal trapped in a maze, confused, then crazed, somehow beating its head against an unyielding door. Indeed, his friends called him Ozzie Rabbit. His was always a high nervousness, a withdrawal, a quivering fright. And as with so many who walk alone, he dreamt the dreams of grandeur. The little men, the Napoleon men, these twilight men will somehow reach out and remake history and wrench history to their own will. Lee Harvey Oswald became a Marxist at the age of 13 or 14. Why? It's hard to know, but certainly his political convictions came to him out as a reflex of his psychological world rather than of political conviction. His world was gray and poor and deprived, and he resented the society which seemed to have imposed these restrictions, this want upon him. And he became bitter and outspoken against the American economic system. He needed to be a man. And in an act of desperation at the age of 16, he joined the military service that makes men, the Marine Corps. But you cannot become a man overnight, even under the magic of a Marine Corps drill master. And he walked alone, and he walked unhappily. And he found that though he had learned the art of killing, he had not learned the art of being one among many, of being accepted for himself. Here too he was Ozzie Rabbit. And within a week of his discharge from the Marine Corps, he was in Moscow, knocking on the doors of the Russian government requesting citizenship. And here too, this little man was rejected, for the Russians rejected his application. Desperate, he attempted suicide. And finally, the Russian government relented to the extent of giving him an employment visa, and allowing him a placement as a worker in a factory at Minsk. Why had Oswald gone to Russia? Who knows? But surely to find a serenity, an acceptance, a freedom, a dignity he'd never found in our own land. But he did not find it in Russia. Men are hard on their fellow men the world over. Men are men whatever their economic system. In Russia, he found rejection, the jibe. He walked alone. And in his little diary, he records his growing disenchantment with the Soviet. He wrote, "There is no choice. There is no choice, really, between America and the Soviet. In the one, there is oppression, and the other, there is poverty." He wanted to be freed of the crippling and hobbling restrictions of his own personality. He sought that freedom in a change, an exchange of geography, and it cannot be found. You cannot find it by fleeing where you live. He reached out for love. He found a little Russian girl whom he believed himself to be in love with. He proposed. He was rejected. And within a week, he was married to another woman. And in this marriage, too, he was unlucky. For it was a marriage of constant crisis and prolonged estrangement. They returned to America, looking for another serene land, another homeland in which Oswald could feel himself a human being. This time it would be Castro's Cuba. This time he would have the proper credentials. He seems to have gone to New Orleans and to have established there a one-man Fair Play for Cuba committee and to have gotten himself some notoriety. He would be accepted. He went to Mexico City. He knocked on the door of the Cuban legation. He asked for a visa. And again, this little man was rejected. Cuba would not have him. Wherever he turned, he was caught in the maze. He became increasingly desperate and crazed. He beat his head like an animal against the unyielding door. Now, I am not one of those who believes that the deprivation of one's childhood excuses any and all adult excess. Surely there are those who have been raised with equal drabness who have grown into dignity. Surely the failing was in the boy as much as in his boyhood. But I put to you that we have in this tragic little human animal's life reflected something of the tragedy of our own age. It's an almost classic illustration of do-it-yourself pathology. Have children and deny them love. Have children and do not listen to them. Have children and when they get in the way, ship them off to relatives. Have children and when they reach out to be heard, when they need to be protected, complain to them of your own problems. Turn to them a cold shoulder. Tell them to get their education on the city streets. Lee Harvey Oswald was emotionally starved. He needed love. It was never given to him. Can we extrapolate from his life to that of our own society? I believe we can. I certainly have been increasingly disturbed by the rising crescendo of violence in the land. One of the little commented facts of this election is this, that almost every week there is another reported assassination plot against the President of the United States. And how often has his challenger been pelted with vegetables and eggs and all manner of garbage? Almost every political meeting has at its outskirts a group of the young, shouting ugliness, bustling about. The young disturb our parks and our city streets, and they throw the rocks. It is generally the young who are the disturbing element. Lee Harvey Oswald was young. He was only 24 years old when he took the life of the President of the United States. What's wrong with our youth? With most of them, nothing. With some of them, loneliness, emotional isolation, fear, evasiveness, withdrawal. They feel themselves shut out from the larger world about, and so they build for themselves a counterpart world. The gang, the black leather jacket, the motorcycle, the shocking clothes, the hairdo, the dress. And they make the adult world pay a price for its coldness, for its estrangement, for having turned away. The Aussie rabbits of our society are turning against our society. They are demanding for us tenderness, attention, acceptance, patience. All too often, we have denied these to them. But whatever we believe about our abundant society, it is not one of the best of all possible worlds for our children. They ask for love and we give them things. They ask for a teacher and we give them television. They ask for a family and we give them four walls and three square meals. They ask for attention and we are too busy. They ask for love and we are concerned with our pleasure. They ask for our presence and the family is always out of the home. If you would understand the rising violence abroad in the land, understand the growing depersonalization of our society, where our homes are not homes, where our families are not families, where our parents are often not parents, where we are preoccupied with profit and with pleasure and with profession, but not with people. We are tender with our egos, but not with our others. Note this too, as we rehearse the history of Lee Harvey Oswald. He was a little man, a pitiful, tragic little rabbit of a man. He was one of the unknown men, the anonymous mass, those we never pay attention to. And yet at the one moment in time, this little man, this little rabbit of a man reached up and he changed the course of history. Little men dream too. Little men need to be part of this world. We must welcome them into this world. Let us recognize also that the little men make history. We make history. Had Lee Harvey Oswald's mother been a mother, I doubt that Jacqueline Kennedy would today be a widow. Had Marina Oswald been a warm and tender wife, the president would have come to Dallas and left in safety. We are the makers of history. There is no history which is not written by men, and we are the shapers of those who will make history of the next generation. How will they grow? Decency, capable of loving and of being loved, or in fear and desperation and loneliness? There are tens of thousands in this city and in all cities who are growing up in fear and desperation and lowliness, and who will exact a price, a vengeance in time upon this society. There are no tides, inevitable tides, in the history of nations. A nation comes to high tide when its individual citizens are not only willing to pursue their individual destinies, but will take the time to share, to love, to relate to be part of, to be gentle with their children, their families, their husbands, their wives, their parents. And a nation comes to its lowest state when its individual citizens are preoccupied with profit and pleasure and have no time, no time for people to be with, to share, to be among. Then the nation is simply a collection of individuals, each bustling and elbowing against the other, each grasping, demanding, tearing one another apart. Who killed President John Kennedy? The answer is clear and certain: Lee Harvey Oswald. But are we equally clear as to the meaning of this killing? Whereas we recognized at the very moment of its happening, it is symbolic of much that is of concern to us in our age. Do we see it as a statement of the growing coldness, the steel coldness of our society, of our growing selfishness, of our growing self-centeredness, of our ego enlarged, demanding adulation, its own life, unwilling to share, to love? And how shall we properly memorialize our fallen president? Shall we have an annual rehearsal each yard site of the tragedy? Shall we have only a black bordered portrait on our mantle? This is sentimental and maudlin, and not proper to the quality of the leader who has fallen. What did he ask of us? A giving of ourselves. A reaching beyond the narrow confines of our private lives to be part of the strength of the nation. Time, attention, love, tenderness, sacrifice, and a concern for the well-being of others, those near, those who are neighbors. Can we not, each of us, grant him that wish?